From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week brought wall-to-wall media coverage devoted to the Senate confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Samuel J. Alito. This is, of course, a momentous event. Justices do serve for life, after all, and shape the legal underpinnings of the republic. This is reason enough to cover the hearings, but perhaps there is another as well. As the week went on, some of the coverage took on another aspect, that of a civics lesson. The mass media were actually informing us about the issues at stake. Legal analysts discussed precedent, senators bickered about procedure, and Judge Alito staked out clear positions on a variety of key issues. Well, two out of three isn't bad. Here to talk with us about these illuminating moments and some of the less illuminating ones as well is Tony Morrow, Supreme Court correspondent for Legal Times and American Lawyer Media. He's been closely watching the hearings, and he joins us now. Tony, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, we certainly did not see from Judge Alito a whole lot of detail about his positions on some very central issues. Here is what at least one of his answers sounded like.
Answering the question of whether the Constitution provides a right to free speech is simply responding to whether there is language in the First Amendment that says that the freedom of speech and freedom of the press can't be abridged. Asking about the issue of abortion has to do with the interpretation of certain provisions of the Constitution.
We heard a lot of that, didn't we?
Yes, we sure did. And he, like most nominees in the last 20 years or so, has felt it necessary to put off questions like that. He feels that if he even hints at what he really thinks about an issue, that he will be prejudging cases that could come before him. A lot of people think that's a thin argument, because if impartiality means anything, then they'll set aside their personal views anyway, so he may as well tell the public what those views are.
Well, of course, since Robert Bork was borked some 20 years ago, nobody's been particularly forthcoming under these circumstances. At least one senator suggested that the Senate change the way it goes about the confirmation process and do away with the hearings altogether. Here's Joe Biden on that subject.
I don't know. I'm not sure there's much value to these hearings anymore. I think maybe we should go back to the old days where you just debated it on the floor of the United States Senate.
Well, I think the system is broken. I think these hearings really have turned into little more than political theater, and senators feed that as well by a lot of grandstanding and not very much listening. But I don't think going all the way to just putting a nominee up on the Senate floor and having a few speeches and then voting is the way to go either.
What we mostly learned about Judge Alito is that he's perfectly capable of evading direct questions and examination. But, you know, I learned a lot of other stuff as well, as I often do, even in these theatrical settings. I learn a lot about case law and precedent and procedure. Were there any moments in this for you that you thought were particularly illuminating about the way our judiciary works?
Well, take this issue that's come up in the news about President Bush's domestic surveillance program. Alito had given a speech in 2000 on a concept called the unitary executive, which is a concept of the presidency that is very muscular and very strong. Because of Bush's domestic surveillance program, the Democrats raked him over the coals about it. I'm not sure he really answered their questions, but along the way, I think there was a good discussion about the balance of power in wartime.
We got to see something about how the judiciary works. We also got to see how the Judiciary Committee works. There was a little inter-party squabbling between Chairman Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, the Republican head of the committee, and Democrat Teddy Kennedy from Massachusetts. It sounded like this.
And we're going to have votes of this committee again and again and again until we have a resolution.
Senator Kennedy, I'm not concerned about your threats to have votes again, again, and again.
What was America to make of that little squabble?
There are two senators up there with big egos. It provided, you know, one of the few sparks, and, you know, the media always likes sparks and controversy.
On a more basic level, doesn't it tell the viewer that, oh, yes, there is a majority and there is a minority? That's civics, ain't it?
It sure is. Now, that is part of the lesson of the entire week, that the Democrats are in the minority and that they're not going to be able to influence this process too much.
Okay, so I understand why you think there was quite a bit of theatrics involved as opposed to actual substance. But we've heard about the politics of the Democrats and the Republicans on the committee. We've learned something about the constitutional underpinnings of presidential power and in the Congress. And we've even seen Mrs. Alito leave the hearing room in tears. It seems like a pretty full plate the media served up here.
Oh, absolutely. I hadn't thought of it that way, but it is a full program. I just hope that people continue to pay attention to the Supreme Court, but I have a suspicion that unless another justice retires, the public will put it on the back burner, as it usually does.
Tony, thank you very much.
Glad to be with you.
Tony Morrow is Supreme Court correspondent for Legal Times and American Lawyer Media. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C.
During the Alito hearings, Republican Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania raised an issue that was dear to his heart, cameras in the courtroom, even the Supreme Courtroom. He's for them.
Were the court allowed TV?
The issue is a little bit different on the Supreme Court, and it would be presumptuous for me to talk about it right now, particularly since I think at least one of the justices has said that a television camera would make its way into the Supreme Court courtroom over his dead body, so I wouldn't want to comment.
Well, let me ask you this, Judge Alito, will you keep an open mind?
Brian Lamb is founder and CEO of the Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network, better known as C-SPAN. He's lobbied for nearly two decades on behalf of cameras in all appellate courts, including the Supreme Court, and he says they would perform an important educational function.
This is the one branch of government that no one sees. The only time you see a member of the court is when they allow our cameras to cover them or when they're testifying in their confirmation hearings or one other time, and that's when they have to go to the Congress for their appropriations process. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, our whole point has been all along that the American people, I don't know you say have a right, but I do think they have a right to see the oral argument portion of the court only.
Can you remember what Rehnquist's response was or what the response of anybody you petitioned back in those days was?
Usually the response from the court is, thank you for your letter.
And that was it?
Yeah, really. They don't have any requirement to talk to us about this. And you don't often get the opportunity to interview someone from the court. I've done it four times with Chief Justice Rehnquist. But it's not something that I like to push because of my perch at C-SPAN.
Well, it was Justice Antonin Scalia, among others, who has suggested that cameras in the courtroom would have a kind of sensationalizing effect.
I can understand why any member of the court would think that it might sensationalize the proceedings, but keep in mind a number of things here. First of all, the Chief Justice has the control of the court, and any time anybody's getting off mark, all he has to do is tell them to get back on mark. There's no jury in the room, and a lot of people think there is. The arguments themselves are only an hour long with a half hour usually to each side. It's not that big a deal to put inobtrusive television cameras in the room with a little bit of increase in the light level, but not much, and let the public see what is often not very exciting. And it won't become exciting if you're talking about a land case just because there's television in the courts.
I'm entirely persuaded that television wouldn't change the proceedings in the Supreme Court in any significant way. However, in the 25 years or so that C-SPAN has been airing live footage of Congress, there have been definite changes in deference to the presence of those cameras, wouldn't you say?
Well, I've tried not to answer that question directly because everybody gets nervous when somebody like me says that we've had an impact on the process. I think, though, you just have to look at the obvious thing about television. Anytime a television camera comes into a room, it changes something. If nothing else, somebody somewhere in America is watching every speech from the floor of the House of Representatives. And I don't know about you, but I remember times when I was sitting up in the gallery and there wasn't anybody in there and no one was paying attention in the chamber to who was speaking, let alone somebody outside the chambers.
That's right. Famously, Newt Gingrich and many others in the period of the new Republican Revolution used that empty House of Representatives to preach to the nation through C-SPAN. And certainly the Republicans have not, by a long shot, been the only ones to do it. The line of communication through that camera in the congressional chambers is much closer for anybody who likes to consume that stuff wall to wall. And it's always surprised me how many people actually do like to consume it just that way.
You know, the one thing to keep in mind about television in Washington or around politicians is that they always make these decisions behind closed doors anyway. We won't have our cameras back in those private meetings. And if you really look at how decisions are made, they're made through briefs, which you can read. They're made somewhat through the oral argument, but they're then made in conference and among clerks. And so you can overdo the significance of a possible change from cameras because a lot of this stuff is wired long before it ever becomes public debate.
Well, just because a lot of this stuff is canned isn't as significant as the fact that all this canned stuff is now distributed so widely and the Congress people on the floor perceive a whole new audience for their speechifying.
But it's a very important educational function. The American people have never known much about their Congress. Now with the internet and what we do and what you do and what everybody else does, you can sit far away from Washington and stay in pretty good touch with the mood and the substance of what's happening.
Now, after John Roberts was confirmed as Chief Justice, you sent him a letter that was similar to the one that you sent Rehnquist so long ago. Any response yet?
He responded within 3 days, which kind of surprised me because I wrote it to him on the Monday, the 3rd of the October, first day of the court, and I had an answer by the 6th.
Thank you for your letter?
Basically.
We'll get back to you?
I don't even think he said, we'll get back to you. I think he said, thanks. No, they don't go very far. I actually thought years ago, and I predicted 20 years ago, that we would be in the Supreme Court in 5 years, and you can see how good I'm at it. Frankly, in my opinion, the court won't go on television until either there's public pressure or somebody inside the court, like the Chief Justice, is convinced it's the thing to do. Congress can pass a law, but nobody really knows whether or not it's constitutional. And guess who would have to make that decision?
All right. Brian, thank you so much.
Nice to be with you, Brooke.
Brian Lamb is founder and CEO of C-SPAN.
Coming up, predictions of a web disaster to equal 9/11, and misreporting leads to bad science and financial fudging.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When it comes to computers, every season is flu season, or at least virus season. In fact, the little buggers are now so common that a federally funded Center for Internet Security stopped keeping annual tabs on them 2 years ago. But while most of us know too well how annoying viruses can be, we've yet to see one pernicious enough to crash our interconnected society. In the current issue of Legal Affairs magazine, Jonathan Zittrain warns us to brace for an internet disaster so far-reaching it could ultimately squash the innovative spirit that has brought us services like web browsers and instant messaging. Zittrain says that doomsday event is more or less built into the architecture of the net, which he describes as an hourglass. Picture a big group of inventors at the top and infinitely adaptable home computers at the bottom, with just a dangerously slim corridor in between, which is our simple internet protocol that serves as a kind of fast track for sending computer code without traffic lights or traffic cops.
What makes the architecture of the network an hourglass is that the informal but quite significant group of internet architects who worked on internet protocols starting in the late 1960s, have updated them through the 70s and 80s, they wanted to maintain a network that was agnostic about how it might be used and as simple as possible so that the network would not become bogged down by features. Now, what kind of features might we mean? Things like error correction to make sure that a packet of data arrives in the condition in which it was sent, or even return receipt so that you know whether the data got there or not. All the features that maybe we expect from DHL or Federal Express, these are features that the network was designed not to provide so that it could just almost mindlessly pass packets in the general direction in which they were intended to go and let those endpoints of the network worry about such things as, hey, I just sent you a packet. Did you get it? If so, send me one back.
You call this period a sort of Shangri-La, a creative chaos where no one is watching, and you anticipate that it's going to come to a crashing end really soon.
Well, the worry is that we could see a watershed event. You take any of these viruses that so far, thanks only to the forbearance of the hacker who wrote the virus, it hasn't done anything so terrible, and you add just a little more poison to them, and you say, wipe the hard drive clean, or go into spreadsheets and start transposing numbers, and you'll have a phenomenon where lots and lots of people who use computers will find them smoking on one Tuesday morning, and business environments can't generate their payrolls, people can't pay or receive bills, they can't check in at airlines.
In your article, you liken what you call the watershed moment to a September 11th-like event in that it could actually prompt a Patriot Act in response. What sort of legislation are you talking about there?
I could see regimes emerging, not just from, say, federal law, but from the information technology companies that would, in essence, require one to have a license to code, either literally or de facto. It's the kind of thing where, hey, you can be off in a corner writing code, but unless it's been approved by certain powers that be, don't expect that there'll be any route by which to deploy it to lots of machines.
But that doesn't sound that bad to me.
I don't think it will sound that bad at the time we want to do it. And there are elements of that solution that are, yes, it's a solution to a real problem. And in some ways, my article is a message intended for the freedom camp, for the anarchy-loving camp, to say, hey, guys, we have to wake up. There's a real problem here. You can't just say these are ignorant people that don't know how to install antivirus software. They've got whatever's coming to them. That's not a solution to the problem. But my message is also to the law and order types to say you don't want a solution that burns the house to roast the pig.
So what do you do? How do you go about protecting everything that's so wonderful about the internet as we know it?
I think we have a variety of things we have to do. One is we may have to turn to that hourglass and say, you know what, it may be time to widen the middle of it a little bit. As much as it pains us as network engineers, we might try to make the network just a little bit smarter so the endpoints don't have to be so smart and so perfectly configured. Another thing we ought to do is, in essence, have a kind of Manhattan Project to come up with ways that consumers can know what sort of software they're about to encounter and run. There's some collective wisdom of the crowds. The fact that there are so many people using it can be harnessed to our advantage to say, all right, how many people were running this code last week? Is this like suddenly shooting to the top of the charts, maybe like a virus would? Or is this code that's been around and stable for a good 6 months to a year? Is it ready for prime time?
So basically, the big conclusion here is once something becomes so vital to our lives, so important, it can no longer be free.
Unless we can thread the needle and say, you know what, we're going to have two zones. We're going to develop these PCs so that they can, on Tuesdays, act like an appliance. And on Wednesday night, when we really want to try something new, we can have some corner of them devoted to trying something new without putting the Tuesday machine at risk. There are technologies emerging that might make that possible, even with one box you buy at Walmart. Figuring out how to let it be stable when it needs to be stable, but be wonderfully, productively anarchic when we want it to be anarchic, that's the puzzle before us.
All right. Jonathan, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Jonathan Zittrain is co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. His article, Without a Net, is the cover story in the current issue of Legal Affairs magazine.
Before we get too deep into 2006, we thought we'd take one last look at some of the ways in which the media got it wrong in 2005. A George Mason University group called Stats compiled a group of the most egregious examples from the past year. Rebecca Golden is Director of Research for Stats, or the Statistical Assessment Service. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
At the top of your list is a story we've actually discussed before on this show, the idea that methamphetamine is sweeping the country and harming us in ways unprecedented in the war against drugs. How could you demonstrate statistically that the meth mania was exaggerated?
Well, the easy kinds of things to do is to look at trends of drug use by kids, for example, who are in high school. And what we saw was that meth use had been going down over the past couple of years, and that its current rate, 4.5% of high school seniors have tried it in their lives, is pretty comparable to the rate of people using crack. There are other drugs that are even worse. Cocaine in general has usage rates more like 8% currently. Cigarettes and alcohol, of course, are abused regularly, always have been. The other thing that you can look at, as opposed to just what happened in the past year, is just is 4.5% of people trying something really awful, or is it not so awful? What percentage of those people actually get addicted? And what we found, again, the rates were comparable to drugs like crack. So while we're not saying that methamphetamines are a good thing, what we are saying is that meth is no worse a drug than other bad drugs that in the past have been demonized.
Now, the meth problem was reported by many, many news outlets. The second item on your list of 2005 health journalism don'ts was about one media outlet, Good Morning America, and a so-called exclusive investigation it did on poison popcorn.
That's right. There was a drug called Zonal RP, and people suspected that it may either itself directly cause cancer or turn into something that causes cancer inside of our body. And this is a substance that's found on popcorn bags, fast food boxes, candy wrappers, other plastics that need to be protected against grease stains. But the question as to whether the substance actually does migrate into our food and whether the fact that it migrates into our food actually does cause cancer is often entirely ignored by the media. So you get a headline that just says, oh, the Food and Drug Administration has opened an investigation into its safety, without any follow-up as to whether they found something, didn't find something, what were the studies. In this case, it turned out to be a total red herring. There was no actual proof of any cancer that was caused, and there was no follow-up in the media. So we have a conflict where it's not news to say something doesn't cause cancer. It's only news to say it might.
Some of the most alarming stories seem to come from experiments with various substances that may or not be carcinogenic based on their administration to laboratory rats, but without any human studies to suggest that it has any kind of similar effect in humans. When journalists see that kind of research being cited, should they smell a rat? What should they do?
That's a good question. I think the first thing they should do is talk to the scientists who are involved in the study on rats to ask them the following questions. First of all, is the dosage that is given to the rats comparable to something that we would expect humans to be exposed to? Because toxicity is all a question of dosage. And the second question is whether the mechanism from which rats are developing cancer is a mechanism that could exist in humans. So sometimes you find that something is carcinogenic in rats because they can't digest some substance that, in fact, humans do digest. In general, I'd say the conclusion you can draw from a study on rats is that it might be true for humans, and further study is needed.
So we've established that alarming stories seem to get the media's attention, not necessarily with a whole lot of context. But another major category of reporting on health, especially behavioral health, is the trend story.
Here we saw a whole spate of stories saying that teenagers were having more sex, drinking more. The accusations were also that they were more depressed, they had more ADD, and in general putting themselves at risk more. But what we found, again, by just looking at the numbers, was that kids were having less sex with fewer partners. The rate of oral sex, which was one of the big accusations that this was a new epidemic, have been staying constant. We saw that the alcohol use was going slightly down, drug use was going slightly down, cigarette use was going slightly down, and suicide rates were going down. We did find that depression rates had been going up, as did ADD rates, but no one's clear whether that went up because there's better diagnosis and treatment for these things, or whether because people are in fact more depressed than they used to be. So the stories that went on about how teenagers are ruining themselves and the future of American society is somehow being ruined were really misplaced.
Okay, Rebecca, well, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Golden is Director of Research for the Statistical Assessment Service, or STATS, at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. You can find additional flubbed stories under the Dubious Data Awards link at stats.org.
The saying goes, you can't be too thin or too rich. Many would quibble with the first part, but few, even among the wealthiest Americans, would deny the second. Proof of that can be found in the annual list of the 400 richest Americans tallied by Forbes magazine. Complete with pithy bios and details about whose fortunes have risen or fallen, Forbes crunches the numbers and the ultra-rich position themselves accordingly. But how accurate is Forbes? Timothy O'Brien is a New York Times business reporter and author of a recent book, Trump Nation, The Art of Being the Donald. He's recently written about the Forbes list and Trump's passion for it. O'Brien minced no words in explaining the lure of the list.
It's financial pornography of the most delicious and voyeuristic sort. That's one purpose it serves among the audience out there, the great unwashed among us who don't have millions or billions of dollars. But I think for the people on the list, it's a scorecard. And in many ways, it remains a very male scorecard. You know, who's the biggest?
So you've written that Trump has taken advantage from the outset of the method that Forbes has used to compile the listing. How is that ranking created?
Forbes looks at the publicly held assets of individuals who have stock in publicly traded companies. That's a fairly straightforward exercise when you have a Bill Gates whose wealth is tied up in Microsoft, or Warren Buffett, whose wealth is almost solely tied up in Berkshire Hathaway. It becomes a little trickier when you've got somebody like Donald Trump who has wealth in real estate, which isn't publicly traded. The valuations are always elastic, and anybody that's based in the private world has a lot of leeway to tell Forbes whatever's on their mind, including how big they think their wallet is.
But presumably Trump isn't the only rich guy to sort of verbally declare rather than actually prove his wealth.
I think that's true. And the people who do that are loath to acknowledge it publicly. But I've been covering these guys now for about 15 years. And several of them said, often it's hoo-ha, what they tell the magazine. Donald himself, in the years when he fell off the list in the mid-90s, when he had hit this wall because of gorging on debt that he couldn't repay, Donald himself said, every year the Forbes 400 comes out and people talk about it as if it were a rigorously researched compilation of America's wealthiest people instead of what it really is, a sloppy, highly arbitrary estimate of certain people's net worth.
That's a pretty disparaging assessment from somebody who you suggest fights tooth and nail every year to get on the list and is absolutely furious when he doesn't get on.
But you know, that's vintage Donald. when he's down, he'll tell his critics that their opinions don't matter. And when he's up, he desperately courts their good wishes. It's part of his strange ego.
Well, he does seem to have recognized that there is a certain power to be derived from the list. How has he taken advantage of that cachet?
Trump is, you know, a top-tier smoke and mirrors man. In the popular imagination, if people think Donald Trump is a billionaire, Donald Trump can then tour the country telling people how they can become billionaires just like him. And investors can be lazy. And if they think someone has credibility, they'll go ahead and buy the stock.
And if he is a smoke and mirrors man, you also suggest in your book that the Forbes 400 is a smoke and mirrors list. And as a matter of fact, following an article that you wrote in the New York Times in October, Forbes published a response in which it claimed that its estimates on Trump are in fact conservative, and they detailed, at least to some degree, calculations of his worth. How did they explain their accounting, and what's your response to their response?
They really didn't explain their accounting, you know, and I spent actually a lot of time with their reporter who was working on the piece, and he had no knowledge of Trump's actual history with some of his larger properties in Manhattan, properties that were in dispute. He made no attempt to speak to the other side. Forbes, in this year's list and last year's, claims that Donald controls 18 million square feet of property in Manhattan, which is an absolute impossibility. He just doesn't. And I asked the reporter, are you guys going to get into that? And he said, no. And I said, well, why not? And he said, because my editors told me not to. If they really dig into it and really do due diligence, they're going to understand how severely they've been spun by Donald.
So since we know now how Donald derives some value from the list, what sort of value does the list derive from listing Donald?
Well, it's, you know, what's very interesting is this year, I think they had pictures of maybe four or five quote unquote billionaires associated with the list. And Donald's was one of the biggest pictures they had on the list, even though he ranks on their list in the 80s. And that's because Donald Trump is a very recognizable business figure. I think Gallup did a survey around the year 2000 of the most recognizable or famous business people in the United States, and Trump was number one.
So Donald brings sex to the Forbes list.
And marketability.
But as you've written, despite its prestige, not everyone wants to be on that list. Why don't they? And who are these people who think they're too good for the Forbes 400?
Well, you know, people who are really secure in their identity and secure with who they are as people don't need to walk around proclaiming publicly how much they're worth. And the reason Donald does it is because he's an amazingly insecure person. In the book, I quote Nelson Bunker Hunt. When Hunt was being grilled by Congress about his net worth, he said, "A fellow asked me that once, and I said, I don't know. But I do know people who know how much they are worth generally aren't worth much."
So the Forbes 400 really isn't for the rich. It's really for the rest of us and Donald Trump.
That's absolutely right.
Timothy, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Timothy O'Brien is a business reporter for the New York Times and author of Trump Nation, The Art of Being Donald.
Coming up, when it comes to memoirs, there's the truth and then there's truthiness.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, a website called The Smoking Gun charged author James Frey with inventing a few key events in his best-selling, Oprah Winfrey-endorsed 2003 memoir about drug addiction, alcoholism, and treatment called A Million Little Pieces. And if that's the case, then Frey took millions of readers for a ride. Frey defended his book on The Larry King Show.
My side is that I wrote a memoir. You know, I never expected the book to come under the type of scrutiny that it has. A memoir, the word literally means my story. A memoir is a subjective retelling of events.
But it's supposed to be factual events. And a memoir is a form of biography.
Later, Larry King asks,
are you saying the essential truth of this book? You stand by 100%.
Absolutely. I mean, the book is about drug and alcohol addiction.
Of which you were addicted to both.
Yeah. Nobody's disputing that I was a drug addict or an alcoholic. Nobody was disputing that I spent a significant period of time in a treatment center.
What was disputed was, for example, an account in Frey's book of his being arrested and jailed for felony DUI and possession of narcotics after running into a police car and fighting with the cops. The Smoking Gun frequently posts celebrity mugshots but couldn't find one for Frey, and their investigation took off from there. On Larry King, Frey said that some of the website's research didn't add up and charged its editors with posting parts of an off-the-record conversation he had with them. Andrew Goldberg, the website's managing editor, explained why they went looking for his mugshot in the first place.
We got an email after he appeared on The Oprah Winfrey Show. Somebody said, hey, we saw this guy on the show, me and my wife, and we thought, you know, he talks about being on crack, being drunk, driving into a police officer, the melee that followed, how he got beaten up and dragged down to the station. Would love to see what he really looked like at that moment. And we thought, you know, maybe we'll take care of it in a day or so. It should take us, the way we do documents, about half an hour max. So I started making some phone calls on it and came up with nothing.
You know, it's been kind of shocking how huge this has been in the press. Do you think it's something that the media themselves are particularly interested in?
The media cares because many of them have been lied to by this guy. He's done interviews all over the country. He's answered questions specifically about his time in jail. There was no time in jail. When we had the truth, when we had the facts, when we had the documents, which he doesn't refute that any of that is true, and we said we're going to put it on the site, he had his lawyers send us a letter. They've said that there's a lot of money tied up in books and movies here, and if you imply that my client's a liar or fabricated parts of his life, we're going to come after you for millions of dollars. So he tried to stifle the truth. There's one other quick point I want to make. James Frey went on Larry King and said that we published off-the-record conversations and he didn't know why we did it. What happened was we had sent him a letter Saturday morning after he had sent us a legal letter threatening to sue us, outlining a number of things he had said to us in off-the-record conversations. It was a private correspondence between us and him, quoting from those conversations. Mm-hmm. He decided to take that letter and post it on his website. Things he had said to us off the record that we would have never been able to use in the story, he posted them on his personal website a day before we even did the story. I think it's important that people understand why those became on the record.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrew Goldberg is the managing editor of thesmokinggun.com. Adam Kirsch is the book critic for the New York Sun. He says that once young writers would get their start with first novels that were really thinly masked memoirs, but that these days literary tyros often debut memoirs that are really just thinly masked fiction.
It definitely seems to be something that emerged in the 90s, maybe starting in the early 90s. You had books like Girl Interrupted, Prozac Nation, which were different from traditional memoirs in two ways. One is that instead of being the life of an older person looking back on what they'd accomplished, it was often written by a very young person around the same age as someone who might in the past have decided to write a first novel. The second was that it was stories not necessarily of accomplishment, but of suffering or pathology, overcoming obstacles, often having to do with psychology, institutions, drugs, and all those things play into the James Frey memoir.
And now that the memoir has become a profit center, then there's more pressure on it to sell, sell, sell.
Definitely. And I think that in this particular case, he attempted to sell it to publishers, Frey and his agents, as a novel, and couldn't sell it. And when he started to market it as a memoir, that's when he got a publisher. I think he said that quite openly. So there's definitely an added charge when you think that what you're reading is something real.
Have you ever encountered the three memoirs of J.T. Leroy?
I haven't read J.T. Leroy's books. I've only read about the whole ongoing J.T. Leroy saga.
We haven't talked about J.T. Leroy before. It seems to have broken at roughly the same time as the current scandal. He published three books about life as a child prostitute and a drug abuser. The books were published around the world. He got a lot of celebrity friends and celebrity supporters. And now it was revealed that there is no J.T. Leroy. This seems to be a distinctly postmodern kind of affair, which isn't really the same as James Fry's, which is probably a simple lie.
That is actually sort of a brilliant hoax, more than a garden variety case of exaggeration, and was clearly the work of people who spotted a place in the market for this sort of book, which is like the James Fry book, a book about pathology and the suffering of a young person overcoming hardship.
You know, there's an author that seems to have been on the nonfiction bestseller list throughout the entire third millennium by the name of Dave Pelzer. He's written a series of books, A Child Called It, One Child's Courage to Survive, and then several sequels, all about his sufferings as an abused child. Questions have been raised about those. I mean, doesn't anybody suffer for real anymore?
Well, they definitely do. The question is, what kind of person is able to express their suffering convincingly in literary terms? There have been many cases like this. The Augustine Burroughs book, which was so popular, Running with Scissors, I think has also been questioned by people who are portrayed in it. The problem is that when you write any kind of narrative, the events of real life get shaped in a certain way. And the gray area comes when you are ostensibly writing a memoir, but using the techniques of fiction because you want to tell a more effective story. That's clearly what James Fry did. The book that it reminds me most of is a Charles Bukowski novel. It's exactly the same sort of story about a tough but sensitive guy overcoming basically a bunch of idiots around him and proving himself better than everyone else. That's a very appealing story because everyone secretly likes to think of themselves that way. But
Bukowski wrote novels.
It was clear that the character was supposed to be him and had his experiences. But because it wasn't a formal claim of accuracy, he had license to do things that James Fry shouldn't have been able to do.
You know, though, even if you have license, if you call something a fictionalized memoir, or you allow the buzz to continue to suggest that it is actually based on reality when it isn't, it can still hang you up in the end if you're found wrong. I think the principal and most tragic case of that may be Jerzy Kosinski's The Painted Bird. You know, this is the story of a child who was separated from his family during the Holocaust and his travail. When it was determined decades later that it wasn't, many suggest it's what led to his suicide in 1991.
Yes, and there was a recent case which was even more bizarre of a guy named Benjamin Wilkomirski,
right,
who wrote a book called Fragments, which purported to be a very elaborate memoir of growing up in a concentration camp as a child, which it later turned out was completely fabricated. That wasn't his real name, and he never had these experiences. It is, of course, very dishonest and unethical to claim someone else's story or to invent a story which isn't your own. And it becomes worse, I think, the more painful that story is, because you're arrogating to yourself the compassion that other people deserve. Now, James Fry clearly does deserve a lot of compassion. In fact, one thing that I've wondered is how he is responding to it personally, because clearly he's someone who's had a lot of emotional problems.
Well, he did dispatch a lawyer to the smoking gun.
It's true. And he has executed a sort of clever PR strategy by going on Larry King and having his mother with him. But if you look at what he said on Larry King, he was continually talking about the essential truth of his book and saying this book is essentially true, even if it's not true in every detail. That's exactly the claim that you make for a novel, that it is essentially true, and in fact that you need to create some sorts of falsehood in order to tell a greater truth. That's what he did. The problem is that he didn't acknowledge that that's what he was doing.
Well, Adam, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Adam Kirsch is the book critic for the New York Sun.
For 70 years, Hollywood has worked and reworked the idea of racial transformation. The 1964 film Black Like Me, based on the book of the same title, depicted the true story of a journalist who dyed his skin to pass as an African American in the segregated South. He tells his secret to a shoeshine man, who then gives him advice about acting black.
You got to act different. You got to talk different. You even got to think different.
Decades later, on Saturday Night Live, Eddie Murphy parodied that film with his version, White Like Me.
Their butts are real tight when they walk. They gotta keep their butts tight. I gotta remember to keep my butt real tight when I walk.
Now, there's a new addition to the genre, a reality show that airs in March on the FX cable channel called Black White. The series takes two families, one white, one black, who are made up daily to face the world as members of one another's race and then reconvene at night to share their experiences.
I keep thinking there's something in the walk. You know, I was thinking kind of, you know, how about a white guy, sort of more straight,
mm-hmm.
whereas a black is sort of like just a little bit of roll.
That's not really bad.
It's just sort of
not really bad.
Bit,
no.
It's equal parts intriguing and embarrassing and also impossible to take your eyes off. Margot Jefferson is culture critic for The New York Times. She joins us now. Margot, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Give me a kind of tour down Hollywood memory lane. Tell me some of the various films that have explored the whole idea of passing.
Well, until very recently in movies, a lot of the passing, the stereotype, that's been melodrama. If you have a passing story, black woman, let's say, who is fair enough to pass for white, she's going to be played by a white actress. And they would have been categorized as women's pictures, you know, weepers, melodramas. And I sound a little patronizing. The fact is, when I saw them as a girl, I was quite mesmerized. In the 1959 Imitation of Life, the tormented Sarah Jane, who, of course, passes, that character was played by Susan Conner, who was white.
And if he ever finds out about me, I'll kill myself.
But why?
Because I'm white, too. And if I have to be colored, then I want to die.
Sarah Jane, what are you saying?
I want to have a chance in life. I don't want to have to come through back doors or feel lower than other people or apologize for my mother's color.
Don't say that.
She can't help her color. But I can.
1949, there was Pinky, the Negro girl who could pass for white and did for a time. And, you know, there were plenty of black people who went to see, especially Imitation of Life. They were compelled by it. But melodrama always has a moral dilemma. For a white audience, the honorable decision must be that if this young woman decides to keep trying to pass for white, she must be punished.
Couldn't we run away? I'd do anything to be with you. Anything.
That's not a bad idea. That's not a bad idea at all. Just tell me one thing.
Yes?
Is it true?
Is what true?
Tell me.
Tell me!
What difference does it make? You love me.
All the kids talking behind my back.
Is it true?
No.
Are you black?
No, I'm as white as you.
You're lying. I'm not.
I'm lying.
Among other things, interracial marriage was still illegal in virtually every state of the Union, if not in every state. And, you know, it was one of the great taboo subjects. For it to be acknowledged at all between a white man and a black woman, there's going to have to be a big class difference. The white man is going to have to be middle class. The black woman is going to have to be a kind of tramp, the bad woman. And in Pinky and Imitation of Life, the woman is a pretty good girl. You know, she's got a nice mother or grandmother. This cannot be allowed to happen. If she decides, like Pinky decided, to in fact stay among her people and work for them, then she becomes the good heroine. So yes, you're definitely saying let's keep each race in its place.
As we got into the 60s, a whole different sensibility began to emerge. On the one hand, there was Black Like Me, which I guess you could characterize as the ultimate white guilt flick. But we also saw attempts at satire. The quintessential example would be from 1970, Watermelon Man with Godfrey Cambridge. Tell me about that movie.
That was a shocker. And that really, in terms of atmosphere, does come straight out of that racketing 60s where the civil rights movement went right into black nationalism. I think that may have been the first time that mass audiences saw a black man in pure white makeup, in triumphant white face, if you will.
But it didn't last long because the premise of the film is that Godfrey Cambridge A white middle-class guy wakes up one day like Joseph K. in Franz Kafka, but instead of turning into a cockroach, he turns into a black man.
Oh, my God. Oh, my good God.
Oh, shut up. There is no God. He don't give a damn.
You look like a Negro.
I know what I look like. Shut up.
I mean a dark one. I mean if I didn't know you.
Will you shut up, Althea?
Should I hide the money?
And his life changes dramatically.
But also comedically. You know, I think that one was a little too dangerous in various ways. You know, he had a white family. He had a white wife. So it's too close to a lot of bones, and it's pushing black and white too close together.
So if we've established that all of these things somehow press a primal hot button, is there a moment in the newest addition to the genre, the upcoming cable series Black White, that transcends the simple stunt of passing that's more than just skin deep?
I was very taken with the black father and seeing him at the golf course. Because you can see his enjoyment and his watchfulness at the same time. Because normally, with a passer, a black person passing for white, what you're supposed to see is the seamless result. You're not supposed to also see what's going on behind the eyes or see a kind of glee. And we do. And that, to me, is worth it. I must say, I also enjoyed, I guess it's Ice Cube's song at the beginning, the line where he said, you know, he went to jail like Martha Stewart, and like her, he told the judge, I didn't do it. And I thought, okay, Ice Cube and Martha, I'm fine with that, you know.
Well, Margot, thank you very much.
It was fun.
Margot Jefferson is a cultural critic for the New York Times and author of the book just published, On Michael Jackson.
Because I never got my race card in the mail. Is that the reason why my life's still hard as hell? I've been to jail, just like Martha Stewart. And we both told the judge that we didn't do it.
I needed a pair of shoes, so I had to go into the pro shop. And then the most amazing thing happened. The guy actually took my foot and put it in the shoe and put a shoehorn in the back to make sure my foot slide in. That feels good.
I've never in my life had someone, you know, they come out and give me my shoe, but I've never had anyone actually unlace it, open it, shoehorn the back, and slide my foot into the shoe.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had engineering help this week from Rob Christensen and other assistants from Katie Holt and Kevin Schlottman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.